Hello, welcome to the Affairs Code Podcast. My name is Cody Vance, your host as always. Our email is theaffairscode@gmail.com. Our blog, theaffairscode.blogspot.com. We have links to everything we talk about on the show today, recording from the incredibly hot and humid Ottawa summer weather, trying to stay indoors and stay relatively cool. You may hear a fan whirring in the background. I will attempt my best to remove that horrible sound. But we are here today to do the first half of our top 10 albums music list for 2020, a very belated exercise, and I suppose we will have to very soon do our half-year list for 2021. But who do I have on the other end of the line with me, equally sweltering in the Ottawa heat, to talk about these albums today?
It's Isaac, the Affairs Correspondent's sometime music guest, and yeah, it's a hot one, currently locked down, but too hot to do this recording in my room, so if you hear any sort of jostling noises, that's the cat. Not much I can do about that, so this can be a bit of a messy episode, but hopefully one of our most focused, so we'll try and deliver on that front.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've decided to make this a bit of a shorter episode, just because we want to kind of deliver something that's a little bit more compact, a little bit more easy for people to listen to. And also just, you know, maybe because neither of us, feels like we want to be recording for an extended period of time given the heat right now. So nevertheless, we do have our top 10 albums this year. I guess, and we did talk about in the previous episode, kind of overall impressions of 2020 as a musical year. I guess one thing that I kind of wanted to say when I'm looking over this list that I put together is I feel like there are a couple of themes here. I feel like, for me anyway, this was an interesting year because I'm basically evenly split between new acts and legacy acts. It was interesting in that regard to see some new artists kind of coming out with some strong records, while there were also some artists that, you know, were on my radar that did deliver the goods this year. I also do see kind of a certain tendency towards a smaller scale albums on mine, only in the sense that, like, the music that I felt was really impactful this year was a little bit more intimate, a little bit more personal than maybe it has been in past years for me. But overall, I thought it was a pretty strong year. When I look over my albums list, I didn't really have to scrape anything in on a technicality or anything like that. I will say that towards the end of my list, there were a couple of albums where, you know, did I think every song on it was necessarily the strongest? No, but I felt the overall album cohered together well. So I don't know. Do you have some general impressions looking over your list as it stands?
Yeah, well, I'll say I think 2020 on the whole was a good year, and I certainly didn't have to scrape together a list. I think every individual album on the list either brings something really new and interesting to the fold, or is a really, you know, tightly crafted and well executed expression of, you know, song craft or tone, and I think all of them, to a certain extent, either connect in some way to, you know, the year that they came out, 2020, and you know, my experience is just going through that year, but also in terms of the narratives within the work of the artists themselves and how they either served as another kind of chapter in a series of works, or developed on past stuff in interesting ways. I feel like all of those were represented. And I guess also, similarly to you, split between old and new artists. So, you know, I really can't, like I said in the last episode, I really can't complain. And I will say, though, a little bit last year, and maybe it's a reflection on, you know, just kind of not really being objective or not, I guess, not trying to be more systematic in how I rank things. But I found that there were a few artists that might not have made my list, but made two or were involved in a two or even three albums that I would certainly put on an honorable, or could certainly put on an honorable mentions list, like the two Boldy James albums that came out that were excellent, or Moor Mother being involved in like three or four projects I think were quite strong. So I think 2020 was the one comment I would give is a little bit carried by, and not that it's even necessarily a bad thing, but I found that the albums that really connected with me more than usual years, there were kind of weird like connections or double ups between certain artists.
I definitely agree with that. And you know, it was interesting in regards to you know what didn't make the cut for me. I did feel that there were a few albums that you know, we kind of talked about in the previous episode. Like there were a couple of things where I was kind of on the fence of like, does this count as an album? Like for instance, Jeff Rosenstock's 2020 Dump, which I guess you could count as an album in the sense of like it is a package of songs that is put together in like a single Bandcamp page, but he released them sort of sporadically. Also, you know, The Microphones in 2020 by The Microphones kind of, you know, straddles that line of is this a track, is this a song, or is this an album, is this a song? So I kind of put it there. And then there were, you know, there were also just some, you know, unexpected surprises. Like we talked about, the Busta Rhymes record was, you know, much stronger than I anticipated. And, you know, kind of represented a little bit of a late career renaissance. But all that being said, you did mention, you know, do you have any formal honorable mentions? Because I don't for this year.
Oh, well, I mean, I guess to formally kind of detail the two-time club I was talking about, artists that had like two or more involved in two or more projects I thought were really strong, give honorable mentions to the Boldy James or the Alchemist for both the Boldy James album The Pristine China and the collab with Freddie Gibbs, Alfredo. Both really strong, came out within like 3 months of each other. And then also to, you know, another perennial on my list, Billy Woods for being, and Elucid, both of whom put out, were involved in the Arm & Hammer album, then Billy Woods having his collaborative project with Moor Mother, which is also, I think, quite a strong one, and Elucid having a collaborative album with his producer, The Lasso. I want to say, I know the name of the project, Small Bills. I'm thinking of a track name instead of the album. It's escaping me. But to say that all of them, including, and then also, like you mentioned, Jeff Rosenstock, maybe also a honorable mention to Charlie XCX for really, more than any other artist, kind of committing and executing the idea of a quarantine album, not just as, you know, an end product, but as kind of an experience that, you know, it was kind of experienced by the fan base, and just, you know, everyone really is just seeing it developing and then being released right as, you know, things were starting. It was kind of a bold risk as an artist, especially to follow up, you know, your kind of, her real impactful album, Charlie, even if it's not my favorite, you know, definitely made a bigger impact than her mixtapes. That was quite a risk to take in terms of putting out an album so quickly, and it was quite a solid album too.
Yeah,
the album being How I'm Feeling.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah. I'll talk a little bit more about that one later. I think similarly, the Mountain Goats record that was put out during quarantine was an interesting one. I mean, it's a little bit more basic than the Charlie XCX album, but I do give it a certain degree of credit there for kind of going with that. And yeah, I mean, the continued kind of ecosystem of Alchemist, Billy Woods, this whole, I don't know if you call it insular exactly, but this kind of universe of like, underground maybe is the right way of putting it, but just sort of paranoid, insular New York hip-hop continue to, you know, have a lot of resonance this year. And for me, you know, I do like those albums. I do listen to them. I do feel like it is a little bit of a universe that I'm still a little bit at an arm's length from. But nevertheless, I did appreciate that they put out some solid material this year. So yeah, we'll get into our list proper, and we're going to do 10 to 6 today for both of us. So I will start. My number 10 is Fake It Flowers by now I'm going to try to pronounce this correctly, Bee-Ba-Doo-Bee, which, you know, a somewhat silly name for an artist, but really excellent little indie pop rock type of record. You may know her as being on a song that was kind of popular this year, did the hook on Deathbed Coffee for Your Head. A song that, you know, I know was very big amongst, I guess, younger people, really got big on the TikTok, as I understand it. Not for me, but I, you know, appreciated what it was going for, I suppose, kind of the most mainstream version of emo rap. But this album really just worked for me as kind of an interesting, fairly light slice of indie pop rock. Some really great melodies, some really great kind of framing of the guitar tones, and really speaking to kind of that 90s alt rock type of influence. So again, you know, think Baruch Assault, think maybe early Liz Phair, think maybe a little bit, you know, more on the mainstream side, and a little bit more you know, hedging maybe towards something like a you know, that 90s trend of a lot of like alt women-led alt rock, but I think really incorporated very well. I think obviously, you know, share some DNA with something like a Soccer Mommy or a Waxahachie, but I think there is a little bit more of an interesting spin to this, in the sense of, you know, it's a little bit brighter, it's a little bit more jangly, certainly has some influences of, you know, 60s style rock in terms of the guitar tones and textures. And also just think, I think the lyrical presence that she brings to it as this kind of, it's almost sort of about these observations about daily life in a way. So, you know, it was a little bit similar to something like a J-Som record, but I think a little bit more pop-oriented and a little bit less experimental on some of the tones. But in terms of the observations about daily life, these kind of scenarios about, you know, moving through the world and noticing things and trying to figure out, you know, where you fit into all of it. And more than that, I felt that, you know, this was just a really solid record that put together a lot of interesting pop hooks in a novel way, and one where certainly I felt that, you know, it could have been maybe a little bit more emotive at parts. I do think that there's certain songs on it when it gets a little slower that her vocal range is maybe not quite where it needs to be in terms of selling it. But I do nevertheless appreciate you know, the whole vibe and tone here. It's just a very light summer type of record for, you know, maybe a summer that didn't necessarily happen last year. But if you're looking for something that has that type of vibe and that has, you know, a little bit more emotional heft to it as well, I wouldn't necessarily undersell the fact that some of these songs are talking about, you know, more difficult things like, you know, like relationships with parents, relationships with friends, also just sort of daily ennui and kind of this, and there is kind of on some of the songs a bit of a sense of dread at the edges, which I think she sells pretty well. Yeah, so overall, Fake It Flowers, again, kind of a silly name, Bee-Ba-Doo-Bee, but a record that I felt was worth checking out this year.
Well, that's an album that I will confess I haven't listened to in full. I listened to a few tracks off it when it came out in June, or maybe a bit in May. Maybe I'm completely off on that. Yeah, I listened, and I think it registered to me pretty much like you described it, not to, you know, diminish anything by comparison, but as kind of in a similar vein to J-Som, but maybe a bit more straightforward and cleaned up. And, I think in terms of a, you know, someone operating in that sound, was, you know, I'll say again, not trying to diminish anything, but like perfectly pleasant, and certainly you know, I could see an album of those tracks being quite a solid album. It's probably not something that I'd go back to just because it's kind of lacking that abrasive edge, but you know, not by any fault of the artist or the music. So my I've actually, and I know this goes against our promise to cut things down, but I'll keep myself really brief on this one. I actually have a tie for 10th place, because it was sitting this morning trying to figure out which of these albums was the last one to make the cut, and I really couldn't do it. It felt unfair, and I think that since they kind of work as a nice study in contrast on music that really kind of felt of the moment last year, I can just include them both. So the two albums are True Opera by Moore Jewelry. That's the collaboration between Moore Mother and Mental Jewelry. And then the album with by Quelle Chris and the producer Chris Keys, Innocent Country 2. So I think that where I kind of rested on each album is that while I think they're, you know, incredibly strong, solid in terms of having interesting, you know, a kind of distinct artistic vision and sonic palette, and just in terms of songcraft, one the True Opera, the Moore Jewelry album, is I think rather slight. I would say the Quelle Chris album, Innocent Country, is maybe just a little too long. That would be maybe the only reason they wouldn't place higher on the list. But I think that they, you know, both of them stand in terms of you know, artistic achievements, and certainly albums that relate to, in my mind, what, you know, it kind of the sense of things where the world is really at the moment, and they do so in very, you know, nicely complementing ways. You know, True Opera is very, it's direct, it's confrontational, it's hard-edged, it's, you know, I think trying to combine a sort of post-hardcore, but also no, really no wave styled, very stripped down punk rock with songwriting that's, you know, it's very confrontational, and, you know, certainly not melodic, but also just very contemporary without seeming, you know, corny or preachy. It just has the sort of I don't want to be, again, sort of diminish here, but like the spirit of resistance, like it really feels informed by a, if not revolutionary spirit, then certainly, you know, a really profound understanding and anger about the state of the world today. And that's conveyed both in terms of, you know, the how their performances come out, but also in these like very repetitive chant, almost chant based, but you know, in the vein of, you know, maybe kind of 80s political hardcore, but mixed with a more like downtown New York minimalist sound. And I think that, you know, that could just seem kind of like an exercise, but it's the it's how, you know, plugged in and vital the songwriting feels that kind of ties it all together. And that's, I had a hard time leaving off my list. On the other hand, the Quelle Chris album, I think in the same way is very plugged into, in touch with the world, and you know, the kind of the ups and downs of life today, and is, you know, instead of confrontational, it has a more reflective approach, sort of having a, the loose concept of a TV station that's kind of chronicling America as this, you know, serialized TV show that's going into the, you know, going through this moment of like having to reflect on itself and its past, and then, you know, not maybe taking that as like a structure to write all the songs through, but as a kind of setup to kind of move through this cycle of more laid back, you know, sort of jazz influenced, but not necessarily jazz rap, tracks about, you know, certainly, you know, inequality and, you know, oppressive state power, but also about just sort of the ins and outs of life, relationships, loss, regret. It covers a pretty wide range of emotions for an hour, even if maybe it could be trimmed a little bit. I still think it's quite a formidable album, and it has quite an eclectic but also consistent series of guests. Is an album that doesn't feel feature heavy so much as it feels like a communal project, or a project that, even though it has like one central artist or one artist, one producer, it has a very it doesn't have a very kind of formulaic structure of bringing guests in. It keeps kind of unfolding and twisting in different directions. So I think both of them were really strong albums, and I hope I've kind of given a sense of why I felt I had to give them a tie.
Yeah, so I'll just speak briefly on the Chloe Chris album. I actually quite enjoyed that record, and actually thank you for reminding me of it. I thought it was a really interesting album, as you said, touched on a lot of different themes and issues ranging from, and I think Chloe Chris has been very good as an artist about, you know, even though he definitely, you know, he had an entire album, you know, a couple years ago called Guns that was entirely about like the role of firearms in America and like examining it from all these different angles type of thing. You know, so obviously a very socially plugged in artist, but one who has a lot of range and versatility and can do more personal songs and that type of thing without it feeling corny or oversharing. I found that album very interesting. I like the style of it. A lot of interesting guests on there. You know, maybe potential song title of the year contender. Was it Graphic Bleedouts on there? I guess, you know, why it doesn't quite make my list is basically, as you noted, that it is a little bit long as a record. You know, I think that there's a couple of songs where either could have dropped it or could have dropped a guest verse and tightened it up a bit. But certainly, you know, he, as we've talked about before, he is kind of in this universe of this insular sort of art rap, New York-based type of universe. So he has Billy Woods, Earl Sweatshirt, all these people on him. So, you know, if you're not into that, maybe this isn't for you. But I quite like the record, and I think it, even though I don't think it's his most pointed record in terms of the politics, and this, I shouldn't even say politics, but the socio-political themes of it, they are certainly still there, and I think what he's managed to do is really make that feel a lot more organic and coming out of, you know, his own life experiences that a lot of other artists who dabble in similar material have managed to do. So my number nine then is the new album by Touche Amore, Lament. So Touche Amore, which we've talked about, I think, on a way back in a previous episode, their previous album, Stage 4, was an album that really grew on me over time. I don't think I put it on a top 10 list the year it came out, but it's an album that I've consistently gone back to just because it's so, you know, emotionally powerful and so, you know, does such a good job at, like, playing in this very, you know, kind of rarefied form of, like, you know, screamo or you know, emo hardcore type of music, but really giving it this sense of weight from the loss that it was really framed around, the loss of the singer's, the main lead vocalist, Mother. Lament is a little less emotionally impactful, I would say, than as compared to that record, Stage 4. But nevertheless, I think it finds Touche Amore in excellent form, a band that I think, you know exactly what they're doing and exactly how to do it. They play with this just perfect knife-edge precision, and they know exactly how to, you know, create these kind of moments of, like, both euphoria and also these moments of really heavy, crunching attack throughout the record. I think the record is maybe a little bit less balanced in terms of those moods than Stage 4 was. This is definitely more of a like a heavier record in a lot of, in terms of the music. I would also say that lyrically, it's maybe a little bit less specific than Stage 4 was, whereas in that album, you had a lot of like very specific and kind of concrete things about, you know, like certain experiences or certain memories that the singer was working through and saying, like, you know, this happened at this point and this happened at this point and I remember when this happened. This is a little bit more non-specific and more about kind of emotions and kind of, and it almost feels more like a processing of what was going on in the previous record, if I can put it that way. It's a little bit messier. It's a little bit less focused, and that's why it's, you know, not quite as good a record. But I do think that they managed to maintain a lot of what I really liked about that previous album, which was this balancing of the intensity and the momentum with a sense of real sense of melody, a real sense of musicality, in a way that you often, you know, even though I'm a fan of a lot of, you know, bands within the genre, you often don't really have. I think that what sets Touche Amore apart really is the sense that they are writing full songs and not just sort of attack pieces, and also that they have a real sense of when to modulate their approach to create the kind of emotional circumstances that they want to drive at. I do think it's, you know, as I say, it's not quite as good a record as the previous one, but I still think it finds them in very fine form. And also the way that they managed to progress through their career has really impressed me, because, you know, I had followed them prior to the album Stage 4, and I always thought they were good. That record made them great. I think they continue to deliver the same goods on this record. And yeah, for those reasons, Lament by Touche Amore.
Yeah, I quite enjoyed that record when it came out. I think it ended up coming out at a weird time in the year where, you know, at least in the wild four-season climate of Eastern Canada, the days were getting shorter and things were getting colder. And I ended up maybe getting taken by a number of very solid other releases that ended up, you know, coming in kind of right at the end of the year. But in terms of a follow-up to Stage 4, that, you know, kind of progresses them as a group and moves on from, it's not that, you know, that every album they make is going to be under the shadow of that or something, but it's, you know, any album that deals with things quite so directly is sort of difficult to follow up. And I think they do quite a good job, and as, you know, a sort of technical and musical exercise, or not even exercise, I mean, it's, again, faint praise, but an achievement. It's quite a solid record, and I think in another year that didn't have so many albums on the cusp for me, it might have been an honorable mention. So my number 8, or my number 9, sorry, is the album by Yves Tumor, Heaven to a Tortured Mind. And this was an album that has really, I think, moved up and down my list a little bit as I've tried to settle in the last week. And it's difficult because I think it's quite a intriguing, you know, record. It doesn't really sound like anything else out there, but in the same vein, it's much more accessible and kind of works as a piece and works with, you know, things closer, you know, tones of pop and R&B and, you know, soul. I guess people would say psychedelic soul. But with just kind of a faint or fainter, you know, experimental edge that was really dominant in Yves Tumor's earlier work. And ultimately, I think it doesn't stand for me on the as strongly as Safe in the Hands of Love did, which is an album that has really just grew on me almost, you know, continuously since it came out. And I think that's an album that's going to age even better. I think that maybe an album under this style could even be taken further by Eve's Tumor and could really stand as, you know, something special. But I think this is also quite something special. And, you know, not to, and if it's the sound he ends up moving away from, I think this will, you know, stand on its own as a record that's worth going back to and worth recommending to people if they want something a little more left field that, you know, isn't kind of abrasive, really. It's as, you know, with Eve's, for me, it's, you know, the details, the kind of change-ups, the intricacies of drum patterning, the tone choices on synths, and, you know, kind of the weird stop and start programming. All these things that it might, you know, another artist might kind of be working in the same collage format, but, you know, using the things with a kind of sort of isolated or as the basis for a song or an idea, whereas all the songs on this have that really attractive quality where they just seem to emerge, you know, fully formed as their own thing. All, you know, all of them, you know, can be reduced, you know, not to say that they're minimalist, but, you know, you can kind of reduce them to a few different components, but in how, you know, guitars are treated and how synths and drum machines are set up, everything just feels a little bit off, but not in an unpleasant way, in a way that makes the music, you know, just quite, I don't necessarily, I think intoxicating is a bit, maybe it's an overused descriptor for, you know, psychedelic or you know, psychedelic adjacent music, but that's really, it's kind of the strong suit of the record, and it serves, you know, in the same way as the other two were, you know, a completely unintended contrast, maybe a more intended contrast to Safe in the Hands of Love, which was not necessarily abrasive all the way through, but felt kind of actively resisting, you know, an easy, kind of smooth listen with its sequencing and, you know, some of the more experimental tracks, whereas this feels very cultivated to invite repeat listens and just kind of draw you in and take you through its entirety. So I think you know, I don't necessarily want to spoil it, honestly. I think if you haven't listened to an Eve's Tumor record, it's not necessarily a bad idea to start with this one. I certainly think that the more of a kind of, the more you go in blind, it's definitely a worthwhile experience.
Yeah, I will have more to say about that record later, but I do certainly agree with you that it finds Eve's Tumor in a much more, I hesitate to say accessible per se, but I would say a little bit easier to get into space and a little bit less, as you say, almost actively resisting the listener at points, which is why I've had some trouble connecting with his music before. I really felt that this one opened that space up for me, and I think potentially other listeners as well. But as I say, I'll have more to say about it at a later date. So my number eight, then, is an album that really kind of caught me by surprise. It's a new band. I hadn't really heard too much about them, but I really, really dug this record and what it was going for. And that's the self-titled debut by the band Teenage Halloween. So, yeah, Teenage Halloween, if I guess I could describe them, it's kind of like, imagine if you had, like, a cross between, a, like, maybe a Gaslight Anthem-style punk band, or like almost or even almost something like a Hotelier type of emo approach, but then all the lyrics are kind of about like queer experiences within America right now, and they also have kind of this much more expansive instrumental palette. So they have some horns, they have some xylophone, they have some different things going on. And yet, it never feels florid. It never feels like doing too much or just throwing in these other elements for the sake of it. This is a very compact record. I think it clocks in at about 30 minutes. And like the longest song on it is like 3.5 minutes. So definitely these are short, punchy songs. But within that, they have a lot of layering. They have a lot of different things going on. There's some, you know, male-female call response vocals. There's some kind of gang chant type of stuff. There's, as I say, these kind of interesting background instrumental interludes with you know, different horns or like percussive instruments. But all of it really played with a real sense of energy, a real sense of, and sometimes ferocity and anger, because of what they're singing about, which is, you know, again, it's kind of all about experiences of alienation, experiences of sometimes violence, experiences of marginalization, but quite often in a sense of, like, you know, claiming your place in the world and being triumphant about that and taking the bitter and the bitterness and the triumph together into the sound, which I think, you know, I definitely think that there's certainly a Springsteenian influence here in the sense of, like, they're playing this kind of muscular rock and roll music, but with a more expansive sort of palette. But I think, and the vocals on it are kind of gruff and kind of, you know, a bit hoarse almost, you would say, very kind of leaving it all on the track type of thing. But I think it's very interesting what they managed to do in terms of taking those sorts of instrumental palettes and approaches to music and putting it within this very new context of, you know, not that there haven't been, you know, queer punk bands before, obviously there have, but just very, feels very recent, feels very fresh, what they're managing to do. And I think that, you know, because they have this interplay of a very, in some senses, older approach to punk rock and, you know, almost, again, like, influences of the Clash, and that kind of, you know, taking the energy of punk but applying it to all these different sorts of genres, not that they're quite as, you know, experimental as the Clash were at various times, but just being willing to play with the sound a little bit more, but nevertheless coming from this very heartfelt place, but taking it in a very different communal and lyrical direction, was something that I really connected with. And yeah, I really like this record. I'm very interested to see what these guys do next. It's a very strong debut. I think that they come out with a very fully formed sound that is truly their own. If I was going to have a complaint about the record, I would say that some of the songs feel almost a little too short in the sense of, like, they could have been, not that they're necessarily just sketches or not fully developed per se, but rather I would have liked to hear them play out a little bit more in terms of that. But I also think, you know, that there's something to the idea of, you know, brevity is the soul of wit, and they wanted to get a more compact approach to these things. So yeah, and I mean, also I will say that, if you compare this to something like a Jeff Rosenstock record, which I do think that there's definitely some, you know, ball of the music industry type of influence with Teenage Halloween. Maybe it's a little bit less direct in terms of its politics. Like, they're not, you know, saying ACAB or, like, you know, naming a song Department of Finance and it's, you know, about how you want to burn down a bank or whatever. This is a little bit more internal and a little bit more about the processes of society operating on individual people and how they react to that. But nevertheless, you know, not that either of those approaches is invalid, just kind of laying that out for you. But yeah, I really love this record. I thought it had a lot of energy, great debut, very interested to see what this band does next.
Yeah, I will confess to not having checked out their debut, but you've certainly sold it on me as something to check out, and I'll say generally that it's never a bad thing to have a band really kind of knock out a short debut that has, like, a real a real kind of promise of a new sound and a new perspective. And those can sometimes, even if they're not as fully realized, be more, memorable albums to their credit. So I'll definitely have to check that one out. My number eight album is an album that we might end up doing a bit of disagreeing on, but an album that I think has sort of maintained my fixation with it throughout the year, and really I think serves as a kind of curveball when this band's legacy is going to have to be rewritten if they put out a few more like this. And that the band is The Strokes and the album is The New Abnormal. So I think that this is an album that, might not grab some people. And I'm, admittedly a Strokes and more, specifically a Julian Casablancas apologist. But, I think, or at least I was surprised to see, some people online, not to say that this is the overwhelming consensus on the album, but just to sort of see the take, that his the albums that Julian Casablancas has put out with The Voids, especially Virtue, were, these kind of exciting new twists on rock, but that the Strokes album, which I think is, on some level an accurate descriptor of it, is sort of, it plays with the Strokes' previous sound and, indulges in kind of a little retro 80s worship. And I think both those things are true, but I think that those are kind of, aesthetic, touchstones that the band, sort of references or draws upon, but that the core of the songwriting, the kind of very crunchy, but, kind of just perfectly balanced production, and, the just kind of totally out there and, instantly memorable vocal performances, which, I gotta say, get me every time. I think it's really one of, in terms of a, mainstream adjacent rock record that, is kind of playfully referential to, pop rock or a, pop rock of the past or sort of 80s, AOR radio or, but at the same time, it has like a real, a kind of desire to do something interesting with each song, and that each song, it acts as its kind of little mini theme park ride of all the different kind of little serotonin buttons that the Strokes know that they're in command of. And I think it's interesting because there are quite, a number of strong rock records, and maybe certainly, fresher than what the Strokes have made. But I think that, there's a certain truth that, experience brings wisdom. And this is, to me, an album that is, it's very tightly polished and, made with a desire to kind of both speak to old fans, but also push them out of their comfort zone a bit, while at the same time not just kind of seeming like, bring the Voids back to the Strokes. And I think on that basis, it's been a consistent favorite for me, even stretching into right now.
Yeah, so I actually will give a lot of credit to this record in the sense of, I think it was certainly better than I expected it to be. And in fact, this shows you how long of a year 2020 was. I actually saw the Strokes in concert at a Bernie Sanders rally in New Hampshire. And they played some songs off this record. And obviously they weren't the songs that, you know, everybody necessarily wanted to hear at that concert. You know, people wanted to hear, you know, Tonight, infamously New York City Cops. But I do think that the record, nevertheless, as you say, did bring some of that experimental edge that Julian Casablancas has had with the Voids into the Strokes sound in a much better way. I would venture to say that this is probably the best Strokes record since Room on Fire. I'm, you know, a little bit more of an apologist for that record than a lot of people are. I think it's quite a strong record, even if it's not quite as good as this it. But yeah, I think that it did take their sound in some more interesting directions and certainly had some very memorable moments on it. And certainly, you know, if you are a Strokes fan, or even just somebody that's kind of casually observed them and liked, you know, their records occasionally, I don't think this is a case of, like, you know, band is putting out a record, do I need to hear this at all? Like, isn't this just kind of unnecessary just so they can go on a tour type of thing? I would say no. Like, I think that this record had a purpose. It had ideas it wanted to get out there. Whether or not I think those ideas were wholly successful or at some points wholly original is, you know, a different matter. I do think that, you know, some people have obviously critiqued the fact that there's, you know, a couple of songs on here that have some very direct sort of almost stolen riff lines from, like, popular songs from the 80s on them, which, you know, I'm not against that per se. You know, you can always rewrite something and reincorporate it. But it does leave a bit of a, it's a little bit of a, you know, are their influences consuming them almost type of thing. But yeah, I felt that this was an interesting departure from where the Strokes have been previously, because I think on their, some of their previous records, you know, post their initial big splash, a record like Angles, for instance, just felt really kind of unnecessary and almost like they were really trying to recapture what was going on for them before. And I think this is a record where they realized, okay, like, it's no longer 2001. You know, we're no longer these 19-year-olds, you know, making music in New York. We're a much different band. We've had all these experiences. We've had, you know, these different side projects we've done. How do we incorporate that into our sound and make it a little bit more robust and a little bit more fulsome and not so just, like, wiry and dry the way that their initial records were? And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. I think those records benefited from that production style. Yeah, so a record that I definitely listened to a number of times, and I think it definitely has some solid tracks on it. I don't think this is, like, you know, a complete write-off, but I do feel that, you know, you're always kind of comparing it, and maybe it's unfair, you're always comparing it to the earlier work. I don't necessarily think it fully stacks up, but I do think that, you know, similar to other bands that came out with new records this year, I did think it, that it had some strong tracks on it, and certainly... you know, it certainly made the case for the Strokes as an ongoing concern as a band, as opposed to just a band that, you know, made some good records 20 years ago. Okay, so my number 7 pick, which is one that you actually mentioned before, is How I'm Feeling Now by Charlie XCX. So yeah, I think you and I have a little bit of a different opinion in regards to this record as far as it relates to some of the work she's been doing previously. And, you know, I think people who have listened long enough to these episodes realize that, you know, Isaac is a little bit more plugged into the hyperpop scene than I am, and a little bit more familiar with that and likes to listen to that a little bit more than I do. I do appreciate it sometimes, but I think he's a little bit more into it. So her previous two mixtape project, whatever you want to call them, Charlie and Pop 2, were records that I admired in a lot of ways and thought they had some strong tracks on them, but nevertheless felt a little bit too plasticky and a little bit too, like, intentionally kind of alienating in this almost Brechtian sense of pop music. Like, we're making it so hyper and exaggerated that, like, you're almost meant to be repelled but also intrigued by it. It felt much more of, like, an artistic expression and a kind of artifice, as opposed to, like, just making some music that maybe has some of those elements to it. Whereas I felt that what was interesting about How I'm Feeling Now, which, yes, as Isaac said, is a record that was mostly conceived and released in the early days of COVID with the heavy lockdown period. So it really does feel very intimate, personal, very much, you know, a record that was, you know, put together using computers, but nevertheless feels very small and very, like, you know, it's Charlie kind of in a room trying to figure out, you know, what is going on in my life. I mean, it is literally titled How I'm Feeling Now. What is going on in my life? I'm missing all these people. I should be touring. I should be seeing my friends, which is, you know, obviously a set of feelings that a lot of people could relate to in 2020. But I felt that what this record was for me is that it managed to get the right balance between genuine emotion and the kind of hyper-pop production that she's been experimenting with on her previous records. Like, a song like the first real song on the album, Forever, uses this kind of vocal layering and these different kinds of manipulated versions of Charlie's voice hitting off of each other to great effect. But it didn't feel like artifice this time to me. It felt like, oh, this is actually what this actually relates to the meaning of the song, and this actually relates to the emotion that she's trying to portray here of, you know, missing people and feeling that, you know, and feeling that your connection is nevertheless transcending these bounds that are put on you right now. And yeah, just track after track on the record struck me, you know, as very much relating to these emotions and really using the kind of sonic palette and the experimentation that she's been developing over these past couple records to an effect of kind of creating this weirdly contradictory space of it's, you know, somewhat cold and alienating in terms of, again, the layering of the vocals and making it very clear that, like, you are listening to something that could not be played live and is like a artificially manipulated product in some sense. But at the same time, it uses that to portray, like, this feeling of lost connection, this feeling of longing, this feeling of alienation from the world, which, again, both very relevant to what's going on, but also just fits in so well with her musical approach on the record. So, yeah, I found this to be both as a document of 2020. I think it's probably, with maybe one exception that I'll get to later, it's probably the most, you know, air quotes, 2020 record on my list. But also, I think that as a document of her forward progression as a musician and as an artist, I felt that this really was able to merge a lot of what she has been doing over the past several years into a space that, at least for me, was more digestible and more comprehensive and more truly felt, as opposed to being a bit of an artistic experiment. So How I'm Feeling Now, Charlie XCX by number 7.
Yeah, I can certainly sort of appreciate that perspective and see why, you know, it might, it in some ways does set itself apart from not just those albums, but her work as a whole to really sort of elevate itself and act as a more, a bit, you know, it does have quite a, you know, kind of a bit of a faint of an intro, but it is a bit more of a sort of mid-tempo textured and personal pop album. And certainly don't think it suffers for that. I think that, you know, part, when I kind of return to Pop 2 and the pinnacle I've put it on, I don't necessarily do so to diminish How I'm Feeling Now at all. I think it's quite a strong album, but it, at least for me, it didn't quite land on that level, I think, because it doesn't have that that almost out of control energy as much, although I think it certainly, you know, is, you know, very direct and personal and is able to excel in that way. There's I think that it's in many ways, like we talked about, it just serves as not necessarily a contrast between good and bad, but a contrast between approaches and an artist, you know, taking different approaches to their sound and finding success in that. My number 7 album is another sequel album, speaking about contrasts, the 2020 album from the Nicholas Jaar, Working Is Against All Logic, 2017 to 2019. This is an album that really came out early in the year And, you know, by stats, I'm told was my top listen for 2020, and it wasn't significantly close. I think part of that's the head start, but I think part of it is also how, you know, tightly crafted and listenable an album it is. And, you know, again, it's, you know, kind of a cliche at this point, but speaking about contrasts, I think it's, you know, makes quite an interesting contrast with Nicholas Jarre's previous record is Against All Logic, which was, you know, a bit more expansive. It was, you know, a significant about 20 minutes longer, and was, you know, like kind of longer cuts of a more kind of, even though it'd be wrong to call it kind of a throwback or retro, as sort of like retro tinged, but still, you know, with a kind of experimental or, you know, more modern and hard edged flourish, these kind of like really expansive, linear house and you know, disco influenced house tracks. And in contrast, 2017 to 2019 is more metallic, it's angrier, it's more compact, it has a bit more of a variation between song lengths, even though most of the songs are on the longer side. But I think what really kind of stood out for me about this record, and what kept it, although I, you know, and I had some hesitancy about putting it on my list, you know, am I, you know, just kind of giving it that's putting it on because I, you know, I end up listening to it so much because, you know, the time that it came out at. But I think returning to it this year, is it's sort of clear just the level that Nicholas Jarre is operating on when he sits down to really make an album. Like the sound choices, the arrangements, the way he, you know, cuts up samples, the way that tracks progress, they all, it's just so like full of ideas. And I think, although it doesn't kind of have the sort of expansive kind of like ability to lose yourself in, like a classic double LP, sort of, bigness that the previous one has, it well executes the idea of a, like a harsher, leaner sequel that is, not interested, not necessarily like industrial, but, just kind of like weird clanks and tones contrasted against, you know, much cleaner vocal samples, strings, piano, and done so in just a really kind of like cinematic way, where unlike, I think, unfortunately, a lot of, you know, house or electronic music that has very interesting tones or arrangement, or but doesn't necessarily have that just particular sense of development where it feels like very effortless and just very rewarding. So I think this is, you know, in an album, and that Nicholas Jarre could have really been another honorable mention for the years. You put out, I think, two other solid albums, Senseus, which is, you know, a bit more abstract and focus on kind of like shorter pieces focusing on, you know, just a few instruments or tones, and a third at record, whose name is escaping me at the moment, which is sort of is kind of a sequel to or closer in concept to his Nymphs EPs, which I think are quite good, and I think his the project maybe pales in comparison to them, but in terms of a progression of the Against All Logic, which is Jarre's sort of more conventional focused, but not necessarily poppiest, because he's sort of almost approached pop tracks with his projects Darkseid and his solo work under his own name, but in terms of just kind of serving up, you know, kind of like purely conceived electronic music that's kind of club music for headphones, and without the kind of more conceptual organization of his solo work, and without the more kind of rock and pop influences of Darkseid, although I think both of those also are like quite formidable in their own right. I think that this Against All Logic album is another winner.
I think the album that you're referring to, that you couldn't remember the name of, is Telos, which is is kind of an interesting record, in that it's, I mean, you know, to what extent you always wonder, but I guess it's supposed to be themed about like star patterns in the sky and that type of thing, meant to give you that sort of feeling. I will be honest and say that, you know, I'm not, this is not my genre, this is not my bag, this sort of, as you put it, you know, club music for headphones type of electronic music. Nevertheless, I did listen to this album, I did enjoy it. I did feel that it was, as it is, a bit of a compilation-y type of record. It did feel a little bit, compared to some of the other Nicholas Jarre music I've listened to, it felt a little bit less, you know, conceptually linked as a whole. But nevertheless, I do feel that it had a lot of interesting textures to it, a lot of interesting things going on in terms of the beat work, in terms of the progression of the different tracks, in terms of the way he layers the samples in a way that's not super obvious and often kind of comes at a bit of an odd angle, which I found very interesting. I would say, for me, if you're interested in something that's a little bit more conceptual, maybe look at Telos or the other record that you mentioned. But if you are looking for something that's, you know, some good, really textured electronic music, it's certainly a strong record. So, coming to the end of this episode, my number six is Do You Wonder About Me by the band Diet Sig. Do You Wonder About Me, we did actually talk about this record in our, you know, it was over a year ago at this point, but our half year episode for 2020. But this record, I think, for me, really encapsulated some interesting trends within indie rock and, you know, the kind of, you know, 90s revivalist type of stuff. But I felt that it had a real edge to it, and a real sense of movement, a sense of force, and a sense of emotion that can often be lacking in the pure revivalist stuff. So yeah, you know, previously I found Diet Sig to be a band that I liked some individual tracks from them, but the albums didn't really hang together for me. This album really hung together in a way that those others didn't, and I think the thing that really sold it for me was the fact that it felt much more conceptually linked of this idea of loss and of, you know, the title being, you know, Do You Wonder About Me, this sort of idea of reflecting on your past and the people that you have surrounded yourself with that you are no longer linked to in some way, and kind of wondering, you know, how they influenced you, how have you influenced them, what have been the things that have led you to this moment in your life. And I think, you know, obviously that sounds a little bit heavy. I think that the way they approach it is obviously a little bit lighter and a little bit, you know, at times there's humor to it, at times it's a little bit more bittersweet, but I think that what I liked about the record is that they managed to put that into a more conceptually unified sort of space, even though this is certainly not a concept record in a traditional sense, but some songs that hit on these different aspects of those sorts of feelings in a way that's conceptually unified and, you know, played with a lot of aplomb, with a lot of strength, and with some really interesting vocal approaches throughout the record that I really appreciated. And the fact that, you know, throughout the record there is this real sense of almost sort of mourning, or sort of like looking at your past self and trying to fit that into who you are now, which I found really interesting, and I found really, you know, maybe particularly in this year where there was a lot of stock taking and a lot of, you know, figuring out what the next thing is. I felt more poignant than maybe it otherwise would have. I felt, you know, throughout the record, some great guitar work on it. I think that, you know, unlike a lot of other indie rock bands in this space, I think that they do have a real sense of when to put those riffs, when to put those little solos, when to put those bridges in a really, really nice way. And I felt that, unlike, you know, and I think, you know, compared to a lot of other records within this space that I listened to this year, I just felt that they really sold it a lot better and that they managed to really convince me of what they were singing about here and what they were, you know, going for. And I do think that, you know, if you're not into this style of music, it may strike you as a little bit rote at times. I certainly don't think that they're breaking the mold in any huge way, but I do think that they're really putting together a record that had just so many strong points to it, so much energy, so much vibe, and really just hit me in the way that I wanted an indie rock record to hit me this year. For those reasons, my number six, Do You Wonder About Me by Dying Sick.
Well, this is an album that I'm definitely going to have to go back to. I think it came out, again, in the spring of last year, where I was kind of locked into a few other things, and it might have come out in a busy day. But, yeah, Diet Sig was a band who I didn't mind their debut, but it wasn't one that really stood out to me. But the way you describe it, it seems like it has that essential quality of rock and roll that, you know, can even if you have like a strong concept and strong songwriting, but the ability to kind of, you know, bang out a song to feel like it has that kind of energy and to, you know, kind of drop the little bridges and solos exactly just right. That's sort of a challenge in and of itself, and an album that can, you know, consistently get that right is almost always a winner. So I'm very interested to check out that one. So I will wrap us up with the final pick of the episode, which is an album that I think might have, if we had done this a bit earlier, be in my top five. But ultimately, I think that there were maybe, you know, the albums that will end up there, I don't want to say deserve it more, but I think makes sense. However, it's still an album I think is, you know, quite strong and exists as another achievement in the band's, you know, quite consistent legacy, the band being Fleet Foxes and the album being Shore. I think it's, you know, for people who have been consistently listening to this podcast, it's no secret that I'm a booster of Fleet Foxes, in particular Crack Up, which I, you know, belong to the minority faction who holds it as not just kind of an interesting left turn, but really, you know, I think an evolution of the band. And in some ways, although I can see where, I certainly see why people might prefer either of their first two records, I think in some ways, you know, is certainly my quota, like, favorite, although that could certainly change from day to day, but the album that really made me a believer in Fleet Foxes. And I think that Shore is in some ways a compromise. It's, you know, it's returning to a more concise, pop-focused songwriting, and has, I think, some of the, you know, a kind of culling of, or a moving away from the imagery which Fleet Foxes has kind of weaved into really all their projects. You know, it still has certain references or touchstones which are, you know, maybe in a song name or a lyric that aren't, you know, immediately apparent. But it focuses, I think, much more purely on melody, on arrangement, and it, you know, in ultimately ends up being not just more straightforward than Crack Up, but I think also maybe more straightforward than Helplessness Blues. And I can certainly understand why people would find the album paling in comparison, but what I think it has stepped away from in terms of expansiveness, it's developed in terms of the consistency and the maturity of songwriting. And I think that it has really some of Robin's best and most personal songwriting in terms of, I think, the directness of the lyrics, and maybe a more, and I think by his own admission, you know, a little bit more of a mature approach to imagery, whereas there were certainly exciting things, and that band is so damn talented that I don't think they've made a bad record or EP, but that throughout this process, or you know, the throughout the all of their involvement in that group, that Robin has been consistently developing and growing, you know, through his life as a songwriter and an arranger, and there's is kind of, at least for me, able to really find a sweet spot between sort of expansiveness and you know, making songs more a bit compacter, a bit hookier, but while at the same time sort of bringing just like an extra subtle layer of maturity that really brings Fleet Foxes forward to me, is it's that, you know, that band that kind of, it's not just kind of an exercise of making music. It feels like a real sincere expression of, you know, whoever's in the group is wanting to kind of put something out into the world. So for me, it's another significant album from Fleet Foxes. I think one of our best working bands. And yeah, I'm obviously biased on the topic, but
I will have more to say about this record later, but I do definitely think that I agree with a lot of what you've said. I certainly think that it is, I would agree with you that it is a little bit more straightforward, both in terms of lyrically, and maybe also a little bit musically compared to Crack Up or Helplessness Blues, but I think that in some ways makes it a stronger record, in ways that I will discuss in our subsequent episode. So yes, thank you for listening to this episode, our 10 to 6 of our top 10 albums of 2020. I thank Isaac for being here on the other end with me. Do you have any final thoughts before we close up today, Isaac?
No, I think we gave everyone, I guess technically 11, really solid and interesting records, so hopefully that'll tide everyone over for a week.
So we will be coming back to you shortly with the second half of our list, but for now, our email is theaffairscode@gmail.com, or blog, theaffairscode.blogspot.com, where you will find links to everything we talked about in the show today. I thank Isaac for being my co-host today. I wish you all a pleasant week.